You're listening to the Plain Bible Teaching Podcast.
Thank you for tuning in to the newest episode of the Plain Bible Teaching Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Soker. On this podcast, we're discussing current events from a biblical perspective. Last week, we had a major news event to discuss for part of the episode, and we talked about the inauguration of a new president. We don't have a new president this week. We don't have any other major news stories. And most of the time, we're not going to be doing that type of thing anyway. Last week was just a little bit unique because that was such a big story. This week, we have three stories that are far less likely to be discussed on the network news or cable news channels. Today, we're going to be talking about the topics of money, pastors, and we'll talk about what we mean by that here and just as we get to it, and profanity. And for links to all of these stories, as well as related materials, you can check out the show notes. Those will be located at plainbibleteaching.com/podcast/012821. So now for the news this week. First story today we're going to be looking at. A new study says making more money makes people happier. Quote from the article says, money improves happiness because it gives people more choices. Matthew Killingsworth from Penn Wharton School finds one of the main links between money and increasing happiness is the flexibility a higher income gives to people. When you have more money, he says, you have more choices about how to live your life. You can likely see this in the pandemic. People living paycheck to paycheck who lose their job might need to take the first available job to stay afloat, even if it's one they dislike. People with a financial cushion can wait for one that's a better fit. Across decisions, big and small, having more money gives a person more choices and a greater sense of autonomy. That is from the website studyfinds.org. You can read the article, the link will be in the show notes, to see more about the study, how it was conducted, how it differed from previous studies that others had done in the past. And also, he mentioned some limitations on the study, and even the researcher, as he's talking about the link between money and happiness, he does caution us not to overemphasize money. But I wanted to focus on one point that was made there in the article, and we read it in that quote. Money improves happiness because it gives people more choices. A lot of times when we talk about money from a biblical perspective, we are quick to point out the dangers of money. First verse we might think of is 1 Timothy 6 and verse 10. It says, for the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and have pierced themselves with many griefs. So we think about that verse. We remember that verse. And maybe there's other ones that come to your mind too, but that may be the one that most of us first think of. The love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. However, money itself is not bad. Paul said it is the love of money that is the root of all sorts of evil. In fact, he said a few verses later in that same chapter in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17 that he gave Timothy the instructions that he was to give to those who are rich, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their mind on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Don't fix your hope on riches, fix your hope on God. And he says there, God is the one who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. That means if you have money, if you have wealth, if you have riches, that is a blessing from God. And in fact, the wise man said in Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 19, men prepare a meal for enjoyment and wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. If you were to ask someone if that phrase, money is the answer to everything, is in the Bible, most people say, well, no, the Bible doesn't say that. Because they're thinking of money and in the terms of the love of money. And surely the Bible wouldn't say that money is the answer to everything, but that's what the wise man said in Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 19. Now, obviously, we are not to embrace the love of money. And that's where we get turned around and going in the wrong direction. There'll be a link in the show notes to an article that I wrote called Turning Blessings into Curses. Wealth or riches or money or whatever we have is a blessing from God, but we can turn it into a curse by adopting the love of money. So we are not to embrace the love of money, but we do need to recognize the blessing of money and the options that it affords us, which is what the author of the study pointed out, that money gives you more options. If we have that blessing from God, then we should recognize the options it gives us in living and giving and sharing and helping and saving, and all these things are good things to do. And so we need to be careful that while we should preach against the love of money, we need to be careful not to do that by giving the impression that these blessings from God are inherently a bad thing, because they're not. And there'll be another link in the show notes to a sermon outline that I put together called Riches, What Does the Bible Say? We need to teach against the love of money, but we need to not give the impression that money itself is bad. There are a lot of good things that can be done with it in helping others, in carrying out the responsibilities that God's given us, all sorts of things, giving to the church, all sorts of things that can be done that are good. We need to make sure we don't emphasize the negative aspects of money and never talk about the good that can come from it. Second story we're going to be looking at today. Americans' trust in pastors hovers near an all-time low. From Lifeway Research, it says, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, Americans are more likely to trust medical professionals, while few believe pastors are completely honest. Americans' opinions of clergy's honesty falls between judges and nursing home operators. Around 2 in 5, or 39%, say pastors have at least high ethical standards, including 10% who say their honesty is very high. For 41% of the public, the honesty and ethical standards of clergy are average, while 11% rate it as low and 4% as very low. Another 4% say they have no opinion of pastors' honesty, the highest of any profession. This marks the second time since Gallup began surveying Americans about their trust of various occupations that fewer than 2 in 5 gave clergy the highest ratings. Now, if you're just listening to this and listening to those statistics, that's a lot to process. Basically, what it means is that 2 in 5, less than 2 in 5, believe that pastors or clergy, however you define that, believe that they have a high level of honesty. So less than 2 in 5 believe that. So 3 in 5 believe that pastors or clergy or whoever, however you define those terms, three out of five believe that they have a average or below average level of honesty, which means they are going to be more skeptical of that. Now, while most people in the religious world use the term pastor, I usually use the term preacher. When someone asks me if I'm a pastor of a church, I'd say that I preach for such and such church. I preach for the Eastside Church of Christ in Morgantown, Kentucky. And corrected, I don't go into a big, long discussion unless they want or seem to be interested in that. But I make the point that I am a preacher. I'm not a pastor. Most of the religious world has a concept of a hybrid between the New Testament roles of preacher and pastors, and that's what they think of when they think of the one who gets up before a congregation and preaches. I have a link in the show notes to an article that talks about what we call the preacher. But regardless of whether this is the correct terminology that's used in the study or that people use out in the world when they rate this, even if their terminology is wrong, surveys like this show us how the world thinks about preachers among us. Even if we wouldn't use the same terms, people in the world will use this same thinking toward those who would call themselves preachers and those who would call themselves pastors. They don't make the distinction. And so because they view pastors this way, they'll view preachers, whether it's me or someone else, they will view preachers that way too. And so if those around us are inclined not to think of preachers as trustworthy, which is what this study suggests, then what does that mean for us? Well, first, for preachers, it means that it is all the more important to live a life that is above reproach. Paul told Titus, for himself and for other young men, he said in Titus 2, 7 and 8, in all things, show yourself to be an example of good deeds with purity in doctrine, dignified, sound in speech, which is beyond reproach, so that the opponent will be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. There are others who are going to try to question us, who will try to question our motives and our life and our character and all of those things. Don't give them any ammunition. Don't give them any reason to be able to point and say, well, yeah, but he does this, or he said this, or he's like this over here. Don't give them any reason. Show yourself to be an example of good deeds. Be dignified. Be sound in speech. Be beyond reproach. That is all the more important. If the people around us are more skeptical of preachers or pastors or clergy or whatever it is, if they're more skeptical of them, then it's all the more important that we don't give them any reason to be skeptical of us individually. But second, for, quote, regular Christians, and I use that term accommodatively, we're all, in a sense, regular Christians. But for those who are not preachers is really what I mean by that. It means taking more responsibility yourself for the role of helping lead others to Christ. Now, this has always been the responsibility of every Christian. And there'll be links in the show notes about personal evangelism. That has always been a responsibility for Christians. However, if your family, friends, neighbors, coworkers, whoever it is that you come in contact with, your circle of influence, if they are more likely to view the preacher with skepticism, that they don't have this view that, well, this person's a preacher, he must be someone who's a man of integrity, he must be someone that's worthy to listen to, if that's not what they're thinking, if their thinking is, well, there's a lot of crooked preachers out there, and there's a lot of pastors out there that aren't worth listening to, and so they are naturally skeptical of those who would be in that type of position, then what that means is that you, as the person they already know and trust, you need to do more of the work, at least at the beginning. You need to do more of the work of getting them interested in spiritual things and leading them to the truth. It is not and has never been exclusively the preacher's job anyway to do that. But when you have this atmosphere or environment where you have people more skeptical of preachers, well, then those who are not preachers need to be taking on even more of a role, especially with the people you know, that they already know you, they already trust you. You need to be working even more, just as preachers need to be working even more to make sure they're people of integrity and above reproach. Those who are not preachers need to be working even more of helping lead those that they know to the truth. And so while this research may sound bad, that the trust of, quote, pastors is at a almost a record low since this survey has been taken, it sounds bad. But if it results in more Christians doing the work of leading others to Christ rather than relying on the preacher to do it, then ultimately that's a good thing, because that's work for all of us to be doing. Now, this last story we're going to be talking about is not really a current event, but it was an interesting link that I came across recently. There was a point I thought was good for us to consider from it. It's about how profanity is performative, and it's from the Art of Manliness website. And it said, in 1934, Rear Admiral Richard Byrd spent almost 5 months living entirely alone in a tiny shack buried under the ice of Antarctica's interior. The longer Byrd spent in isolation, the more he noticed the trappings of his old life fall away. He grew his hair out, dropped his table manners, and, interestingly, stopped swearing. And he says, although at first I was quick to open fire at everything that tried my patience, he observed, now I seldom cuss. Byrd realized that profanity is essentially performative, done for the sake of others. To shock, to evince toughness, to add emphasis, even swear under uttered when alone is born of the societal habit, the hope of attracting attention, and, if the curse was evoked from pain or fear, eliciting help. Now, the application that the author on that website made in that article is not the one that I would make. Of course, he was not approaching this from a biblical perspective either, so that's why his application would be different from the application that I would make. However, I thought this was an interesting observation, that often when we try to teach people about not using improper speech, about not using bad language, we often approach it from the angle of, well, these are the words you don't use. So if we just remove those words from our vocabulary, then we'll be okay. And that may work. Maybe someone is disciplined enough or is able to control their speech well enough where they just, well, just decide, well, these words I'm not going to use, and so they don't use them. But maybe that's not the best approach for everyone, because it is difficult for them to control their tongue and not use certain words. Maybe this idea that was highlighted in this article about profanity being performative gives us another way to combat it. We need, and you know, if we think about, we're doing this for others, well, what then do we need to do? How can we combat this and remove profanity from our speech? Well, if we're doing this for others, and that's what Byrd observed, is that he was doing this for others, because when he was alone, he ended up not doing it. We need to focus more on the approval of God than the approval of men. Not just, well, God doesn't want me using curse words, but just realize that we are to focus on pleasing God. It's not about what others think about us. Galatians 1:10, Paul said, if I'm seeking the favor of men, I'm no longer a bondservant of Christ. So whether it's, you know, using curse words or really anything else, if our focus is, well, what will others be pleased with, then we're not going to be able to please God. We also need to do as Jesus said in Matthew 5:37, let our yes be yes and our no be no, that we are honest, we are upfront, we are open so the people know what we mean without having to add other emphasis. We don't need to add some curse word to really emphasize the point so people know we really mean what we're talking about. No, people know we mean what we're talking about just because we say it, because we're careful with our speech. And we, if we mean yes, we say yes. If we mean no, we say no. And we don't have to add anything to it. We also need to realize that we need to use our words to encourage others, not to shock them into some kind of response, whatever that might be. Paul said over in Ephesians 4:29, he said, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, so it will give grace to those who hear. That is not just about don't say a cuss word. He's saying that you need to make sure your speech is good and right and helpful and will build others up. And that's how we need to use our speech. So maybe when we think about speech and the speech that we use, think about it as being, well, if we're cussing, if we're using this type of language, that at its very essence is performative. We're doing that for other people. And maybe that gives us a clue how we can avoid using that type of language. I've got a link in the show notes to an article that was written by someone else, actually written by my father-in-law, Tim Hale, about the Bible and profanity. A link to that in the show notes. You can check that out and read more about that topic and what the Bible says about it. But that's all for this week. Thank you for listening to the Plain Bible Teaching Podcast. I hope you found it to be interesting and informative and helpful. And for links to the news stories cited, as well as other relevant links, you can check out the show notes, plainbibleteaching.com/podcast/012821. If you know of others who would be interested in hearing this or who would benefit from this discussion, I would ask you to please share it with them. Also, if you see a news story that you think might make for a good discussion, please email the link to me at andy@plainbibleteaching.com. Thanks again for listening, and I hope to talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Plain Bible Teaching Podcast. If you have any questions or comments, please visit plainbibleteaching.com. While you're there, be sure to sign up for the Plain Bible Teaching weekly newsletter. This free newsletter contains articles, audio, sermon outlines, current events, and more. Also, if you found this episode to be helpful, please share it with others.